Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Swan Signal Live. Thanks for joining us. As always, I'm here with my co-host, John Haar. What's up, John?
What's up, Brady? I got the festive sweater here, partially because it's winter, partially because I'm in a building with no heat right now. So if I look a little cold,
it's sweater weather now.
It's sweater weather, my friend.
I've got a little space heater going down at my feet. It is also a little bit... feels a little bit cold out there after last week on the Bitcoin price action. We sort of crabbing this week again, hovering around 90,000. We made a little run earlier this week that was I think we hit 94. I think we got our hopes up for, you know, maybe we're going to break out of this crab market and get a little bit of a holiday rally, but that petered out and here we are at 90k again.
Yeah, the memes of Bitcoin 93K in December 2024 versus Bitcoin 93K December 2025. And pick your version of that meme. They show like a celebrity looking all dapper and then a celebrity looking like horrible, something like that. That one hits
Ben Affleck smoking.
Ben Affleck. Yeah, that's a good one. There's I've seen like so many different versions of that meme, but that one hits a little too hard right now because that's sort of 1 year ago. I think it was December 4th or 5th when Bitcoin crossed 100K for the first time. And then it ended the calendar year 2024 at around 93K.
Yeah.
To just kind of chop around for the whole year. We did more than chop around, but net result to
the
be roughly
result.
Flat.
Yeah, it's
surprising.
It is. Well, I mean, we've been talking for a long time. And in fact, I dug this up talking about cycles and I think the cycles are broken. Thesis is kind of proving itself to be true. We're not quite there yet. We'll see in the next few months. But right now is when we see some kind of blow off top in the past and start some kind of massive drop for the next year or so, down 80%. I wrote this back in 2020. It was a little early. I called it HODL FOMO. I was trying to brand it with something a little bit unique, putting together the two memes, right? The HODL meme and the FOMO meme, meaning you know, we're going to have fear of missing out on HODLing Bitcoin at the lowest price possible. And talking about how the previous cycles had been driven mostly by retail speculation and how this cycle, this 2020, right? The following cycle, the one we've just been through, would be driven mostly by institutions, corporations, nation states that don't panic when the price drops. Instead, they see a buying opportunity, blood on the streets, that sort of situation. That this is a fundamental shift that will basically end the price cycles that we've seen in the past that were mostly retail driven. I was one cycle too early for this, but I've continued to espouse this thesis on this show and on Twitter and just in person with friends and other Bitcoiners all year. And I think it's going to come true. There's going to be a floor of 30-35% roughly, where we won't go below, barring, as I always make the caveat, barring any massive socio-political macro event that really scares everyone. I think that's the case now. Once we get down to 30-35% at that floor, these big professional money managers are going to start gobbling up Bitcoin on sale. And I think that's what's happening here. MicroStrategy bought a whole bunch of Bitcoin this week. And there's some speculation that perhaps that helped sort of maintain that 30-35% floor. So I think that might be evidence that this is what's happening.
Yeah, great find from 2020. And I don't blame anyone who predicted that they choose your term super cycle, HODL FOMO, the institutions are here. A lot of people were saying that in 2020 and 2021. I think now we can say that it was just one cycle too early. It could have happened back then. It didn't. I think now it's fair to say that all of those trends are either happening or more likely to happen now.
Right.
I do like what you've highlighted a few times on this show and just reminded people our kind of consensus thesis has been this, like Bitcoin might go down by 30%. Like that could happen at any point in this new world of post ETFs, post institutional adoption, all this type of stuff. And that did get tested recently. I think that thesis is intact.
Yep.
So we'll see if that holds going forward. And I understand people were a little too early on that first call, but I think like in the long arc of Bitcoin's history, the thesis is correct and will play out.
I agree. I think we're there. Here's another take from Matthew Siegel on Twitter. In view of recent market correction, we believe the Bitcoin cycle has broken the four-year pattern, which is the cycle peaking every 4 years, and is now in an elongated bull cycle with more sticky institutional buying offsetting any retail panic selling. Here we go. Matthew, thanks for catching up. 2020, despite a 30% Bitcoin correction, we have seen less than 5% outflows via ETFs. We are moving our 2026 Bitcoin price target to 150K, with the cycle potentially peaking in 2027 at 200K. Long-term 2033 price target remains $1 million. $1 million.
Yeah, and that's from Bernstein Research that he was quoting, which is a very well-respected research firm on Wall Street. And I would say, I don't know if you agree with this, Brady, but I feel like that, what they just said there, that's kind of the consensus thinking in Bitcoin right now in terms of cycles are no longer going to hold true. And when I say consensus, I mean some majority or plurality of people believe it, not every single person, but it's a pretty commonly held view, I think, at this point, that the four-year cycles will no longer hold like they did. And then Bitcoin, you know, goes up to something like 150 or 200 in the next 1 to 2 years, and Bitcoin at $1 million between the year 2030 and 2035. To me, I would say that kind of feels like a consensus prediction. I don't know, but what do you think about that? Do you feel like others have wildly different opinions?
I'm seeing the consensus come around to this idea, and I haven't actually seen too much pushback against it. I think I've seen a few people say this is hopium, you know, coming down to the end of the year, that we've just basically ended the year where we started and that we're just going to drop from here, that faith in Bitcoin is sort of going away and it's instead going to gold, right? Gold is, you know, the real player here. When the rubber meets the road, the big institutions and nation states are gobbling up gold and not Bitcoin. You know, this kind of absolutely young asset compared to the many millennia old usage for money that is gold. So I have seen those comments coming from the Peter Schiff crowd. And actually let's take a look at the gold cycle. We can talk about that for a minute. So this is, I can't even see it here. Who is this? Drink. I can't see the first name.
Oh, guy. He goes by Tavi.
Yeah. Okay. He writes that some argue that gold's recent outperformance relative to the S&P 500 was a temporary anomaly. He disagrees. This dynamic follows very long-term cycles, and I believe we're likely only in the early stages of this one. Key reminder, unlike past cycles, we now face a trifecta of macro imbalances, the debt problem of the 1940s, inflation issues of the 1970s, and asset valuation imbalance of the late 1920s and 1990s. And this chart here shows times when gold outperforms the S&P 500. And we have just basically a visualization of the bullet points there, the trifecta of macro imbalances. And we're at sort of an fork in the road right now, it looks like, where things have kind of come back to this sort of mid-range line. So, John, can you want to give us some analysis on this chart and Tavi's thoughts?
Yeah, there's a few things that I would like to highlight or tie together on this one. So I do think he's correct that the historical data does show that it's usually not little flips here and there. Oh, gold outperforms the S&P, then the S&P does, and we go back and forth. It's not like that. You can see there's long stretches of time when one outperforms the other. So where I would tie this into the debasement trade, over a long time period, is the debasement trade a good trade to bet on? I think the answer is undoubtedly yes, especially since 1971. You know, you would have done well if you just piled into gold and held. But for the people who want to try to time it a little bit better without being like a day trader, there are cyclical peaks and troughs where the debasement trade can get a little ahead of itself.
Yep.
And then it has to come back. And then during that comeback period, the S&P will do better. And I think we'll probably see something like this same phenomenon for Bitcoin. Obviously, the difference with Bitcoin is that we still have so much adoption to happen. Gold is, you know, everyone's aware of gold. No one's really like hating on gold in the same way that they hate on Bitcoin. So we're in like the first inning of Bitcoin adoption. You can't really say that for gold. So yes, Bitcoin does have that tailwind. But I kind of like the chart because it shows that there's certain environments where the debasement trade is just way more obvious and successful. And yeah, I would take a little issue with the way he characterized it when he said the debt problems of the 40s, inflation problems of the 70s, and the asset valuation imbalance of the 20s and 90s. The 40s had a bunch of 30s and 40s had a bunch of inflation as well. So it's not like the inflation was just unique to the 70s. Like, that's why I think the era we're going through, which Lynn and Luke and others have pointed out ad nauseum, the best comparable analogy is the 40s.
Yeah,
but you know, just look at how gold outperformed the S&P during that period. So yeah, I think the debasement trade is still in the relatively early innings. I don't think you should be like dumping your stocks because of that, but I think you want to be overweight hard assets in this investing environment probably for years to come.
Yeah, that makes sense. Here's another take from Guy, former Swan alum, Guy Gomez. He writes that the Fed essentially announced today a plan for permanent QE. The official design mentions a $20 to $25 billion a month allocation. I guess this is purchasing back treasuries. Is that what he's referring to here?
Purchasing back T-bills. Yep.
Yep. All right. So, but the current liquidity has already pushed the pace to $40 billion. Outlook is likely to continue until April at least. So in other words, more dollars being created, less value being preserved. When the world's largest central bank decides to inflate the system structurally, the message is direct. The dollar dilutes. Bitcoin does it. In a world of infinite paper, absolute scarcity wins. And he just finishes with the single word, Bitcoin. Yeah, so is what's going on with the Fed and these purchases? What do you think this portends for next year? And Guy calls it a permanent QE. I'm wondering if you can divine what he means by permanent here.
Yeah, so this was definitely the biggest macro piece of news on the week. The Fed had a meeting on Wednesday. So right at 2 p.m., you get their interest rate announcement, and they cut by 25 basis points, 0.25%. That was in line with the market expectations. You get that right off the bat at 2 p.m. Then you get a bunch of other announcements and commentary from the Fed over the next, like, you know, 30 to 60 minutes. That was the third straight cut in 2025, just to give more of the context. They definitely used hedge language, as they often do, as they give comments about the state of economic growth, the state of inflation, unemployment, what interest rates might do going forward. They never want to be super committal and say, you know, we're going to do this in a month or things like that.
Right.
So they kind of talk out of both sides of their mouth, to be honest with you, on those topics. But the other big piece of news was, what are they going to do with their balance sheet? And this is what you just referred to in Guy's tweet. So they're calling it, they're not calling it QE. Let's start with what they're not calling it.
They always have new brands for this stuff.
They do. Whoever's at branding at the Fed, you guys are doing great. They're going to call it or not.
Your perspective.
Yeah. We see right through it. But right. I think they do fool the average person pretty well. They're going to call it reserve management purchases. And it's those purchases of T-bills in the first 30 days. They said it's likely to be $40 billion, but then it'll be a run rate of something like $20 to $25 billion per month after that going forward. And looking at this big picture, so this is the first time that they're expanding the balance sheet since they began QT, quantitative tightening, in mid-2022, when everyone realized, oh my gosh, inflation is not transitory. It's the biggest in 40 years. And then the Fed says, okay, we have to raise rates in response to this, and we're going to do QT. That started in the middle of 2022. They've been doing that ever since, with one exception. In March of 2023, they did the BTFP, when there was yet another banking crisis for US banks. That was, like, if you look at their balance sheet in chart format, there's like a little blip in March of 2023. And that's what that was for. But otherwise, since mid-2022, the assets that the Fed holds has actually been falling on their balance sheet.
Right.
Now, we already had the announcement that they were ending QT in December. So we're already 12 days into them no longer doing QT. And 12 days, or I guess it was 10 days later, they said, okay, and actually, here's our plan to increase the balance sheet going forward. And I think this is our next graphic here, but this isn't quite COVID level trillions of dollars added to the balance sheet, big print just yet. And Lynn, being the meme lord that she is, she's likely calling in a new memeable line here, the gradual print. And
this
obviously,
is like a modification of Larry Lepard's The Big Print, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Which I do have behind me. That's the orange book right behind me. So shout out Larry Lepard for that. His book is called The Big Print. Lynn is poking fun. I think big picture, Lynn agrees with it, but she's not calling for it to happen, you know,
all at once.
Relative to now. So she's calling it the gradual print. And my marrying of the two together is like, the base case is now the gradual print, and it'll be the gradual print until something else happens, and then we get the big print. And it can be very hard to predict what that something else is going to be, whether it's a financial crisis, whether it's a war, an external shock like COVID. Really hard to predict when and what might happen there. But if my adult life is any evidence, then it kind of is just a matter of time until the next big print. But these announcements from the Fed this week would show that the gradual print is baked in the cake.
Yeah. I mean, it's nothing stops this train. You just got the little train emoji there. that's the idea is, you know, you just, the debt is driving it. There's really just, it's, you know, forcing the hands of the Fed and the Treasury, because nothing's going to stop that, that spending. It's structurally, impossible to break. It's just there and nobody can change it. Certainly not our political system, which has been perhaps not really trying to, but there have been some politicians who have tried. I think Ron Paul is probably the most notable, but you just can't massively cut spending in the federal government through politics. It's just, it can't happen, because politicians need to make promises to, you know, constituents, and that always ends up in more spending. Plus you have entitlements, spending that's just going up with boomers. And you have all, obviously, the deficit, not deficit spending, but the interest spending, which is now the second or third largest tranche of spending in the federal government. That's not going anywhere. So yeah, you have this just structural impetus for a gradual print. And until you might, you know, get to some event that will require a big print like a COVID, but it's not going back. It just can't go back. This is good for Bitcoin. You know, more liquidity in the system means there's dollars that can flow into Bitcoin, and also the motivation for people to put those dollars into Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. And in case anyone wants a little bit more financial history on this, so what the Fed is doing is similar to what they did in 2019, like 6 months before COVID really took off in the US. Yeah. There was this repo spike. Repo rates went to like 8 or 10% overnight, basically, which is like astronomical for repo rates. The Fed was pretty much blindsided by it. Like they if they knew that was going to happen, they wouldn't have let it happen, right? So they're blindsided by it. And what they did, and what ultimately caused it, is that there was not enough natural demand for T-bills in the system. So the Fed had to step in and say, okay, we're buying T-bills to smooth functioning of repo markets.
Right.
That's what happened then. One other important piece of the history is that they set up a standing repo facility to make it less likely that repo rates would just spike out of the blue to 8 or 10% overnight. That standing repo facility has been tapped recently. So that was like, you always have to remember, in layman's terms, like the Fed is constantly adding band-aids and duct tape to this system. Like now they have the standing repo facility. They didn't have it in 2019. They see people start tapping it. They look at the relative reserves compared to other assets in the system, compared to GDP, et cetera. And then they start saying, okay, it's probably time for us to start adding more reserves to the system and buying T-bills. So that's exactly what happened here. And yeah, they're basically just signaling that our balance sheet is going to grow from here. Remember that most commentators are not going to call this QE because it's not big enough. The Fed is not claiming it's in response to a crisis or right. for economic stimulus. So if you want to play the financial jargon game, it's officially not QE with TradFi people, but it is balance sheet expansion because the Fed's balance sheet will start going up. And it is money printing. And if you get into an argument about that, that one's undeniable. It's money printing. QE is semantics.
It is all semantics. Yeah, this is it's a jargon game. And I like that word for it. It's just a bunch of jargon. And they change the definitions of things when it suits them. And they'll assure everyone that this doesn't meet the previous definition. Here's the new definition and the new word that we're using for it to try to quell any fears or interpretations that they don't want to have occur out in the market, right?
Yep.
Okay. Staying on the Fed, there is a Supreme Court case that has been actively argued in the Supreme Court the past couple of weeks about letting the president remove officials without cause. And it looks like the Supreme Court will uphold that power of the presidency, not uphold, but I guess grant or enshrine in the court documents the ability for a president to remove officials in the federal government without cause. But they are struggling with how to insulate the Federal Reserve from politics. Why are they picking out the Federal Reserve as a special case here, John? And what do you think might happen if they do allow Trump and future presidents to remove the Federal Reserve chair without cause? Third question, what do you think that might do to the management of money in this country?
Yeah, so this is a loaded one, and I'm glad you flagged it. There's a lot of layers to this and debates from like a political perspective, obviously also an economic and monetary perspective if we're talking about the Fed. But just to give the context on the political perspective a little bit more, there's this debate over should there be an agency that the president cannot remove somebody from it.
Yep.
And just this is kind of a caricature of both sides, but just to give it, the people who say, yes, the president should be able to remove that person, they're saying, hey, the will of the people, they voted in the president has the power, president should be able to remove them. The other side is basically saying, we want checks and balances. Some of these people at these agencies are experts, and we shouldn't just have every 4 years a president coming in and saying, you guys are out.
Arguing,
guys
are... making a case for continuity.
Yeah. So that's, I'm not even going to take a side on either one of those, but that's kind of the caricature of what both sides believe. But the reason why I think the Fed becomes interesting here is it kind of raises this whole question of like, is the Fed independent? Should they be independent?
Yep.
Regardless of what your answer is, it raises this question of like, if you think they should be independent, then it's like, why? And why should the people we voted in have no power over these people? And what is the Fed using to make their decisions if the president and other people can't say anything about it?
Right.
Like, who are these unappointed people making massive decisions for society? Or if you do believe that the president can do this, why has the Fed been independent for so long? It just raises all these questions that I don't think the average person has a clue about. You know, this was always an interesting historical thing. I think pre-2008, you would have said 99% of society has no idea what the Federal Reserve is and who is the chair of the Federal Reserve. Post-2008, I think that changed because it was like, oh, Ben Bernanke saved the economy and right. all this nonsense. But anyway, I think most people could not care or understand what this whole debate of whether or not the Fed is independent and what the president can or cannot do. But it's just interesting that even though this debate is surfacing, not really because of the Fed, it's surfacing because of other agencies, the Fed might get pulled into this debate. And hopefully it sparks people caring a little bit more about the monetary system. But that's probably wishful thinking.
You know, maybe relevant context here is the origins of the Fed. And, you know, I know that you've kind of studied this a bit and we can riff on it for a minute, but my understanding is that the Fed was created by a bunch of private bankers and it is a private bank. It is there. There are mechanisms for the government to influence it, but there are no direct political elections for the Board of Governors or for the chair of the Fed. And it is still a privately held bank with shareholders. And so it's an interesting institution, and it is debatable whether or not it is actually independent or should be independent. And what does that mean? But the Fed was established by a bunch of private bankers in 1913 and pushed through Congress with their influence. And they understood that those who control the money really control the power in the country and in the world, ultimately, if you are controlling the money in the world superpower, right? So it's interesting, and it goes back to the whole debate of whether or not we should have central banks. And the country went back and forth from its founding on that question, and there were eras where we did not have a central bank and eras where we did have a central bank. And then since 1913, we've been obviously in an era of the Federal Reserve central bank in this country, which is by far the longest stretch that, you know, this nation's had a central bank.
Yeah. I'll just add a few points to that. That's obviously a loaded topic as well. And The Creature from Jekyll Island is the big book, if anyone wants to dive in. What I'll say that I think the parts that are not controversial, they're just objectively true, is that the private banks do own the Federal Reserve banks. So that part is true. The meetings that happened pre-1913 when the Fed was set up on Jekyll Island, those were very secretive, private, basically like design session meetings. Like, that is objectively true. A bunch of people traveled on trains using fake names and things like that. Like, this was clearly not a transparent process as they set this thing up.
Pretty dramatic, and, actually.
Yeah, it's just pretty unbelievable looking back on it. And then lastly, just look at what the function is. They're basically like coordinating and controlling bank liquidity and basically the whole shtick and scheme that banks have of doing fractional reserve bank lending is prone to these crises just by the nature of it. And I think there were enough crises that happened to that point, and they were like, hey, we want to keep running this playbook because it's beneficial for us, but every so often there's a financial crisis and it could wipe us out. Let's come up with this. I'll use the word cartel because I think that's accurate. Let's come up with this cartel.
Global cartel. Yeah.
Yeah. At least national, maybe global cartel that smooths out liquidity and makes these crises less likely to kill one of us. And we can just kind of keep playing this game for longer and longer. I think everything I just said there is not controversial. It's just, you know, use of the word cartel maybe is up for debate.
Sure.
But, you know, that's the part that I think is just objectively true.
Yeah. The global cartel to me, I'm thinking, you know, World Bank, IMF, the Bank for International Settlements, and then all the central banks around the world. And they do coordinate, you know, maybe it appears to be loosely publicly, but who knows behind the scenes. And, you know, they're following each other's sort of signals. And the word cartel is a little heavy, but it does, I think there seems to be coordination and ultimately an objective to control money through the establishment of fiat money. And in a lot of cases, and very explicitly from, you know, I'm thinking of the Bank for International Settlements right now, and there are certainly other examples about privacy and control and using money to control society and really just get rid of privacy so that there can be ultimate control with this sort of radical transparency through the use of their money. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in that case, maybe cartel is right.
Yeah. My personal view is cartel is fair. I was trying to be balanced. And just on the note of being balanced, what I think the other things that are just important to highlight, the people who would say, hey, there's some balance here, there's some oversight, they would point out that the Fed Board of Governors, those people are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and the Fed's policy decisions require an approval from those Board of Governors. It doesn't come from like the regional banks or national banks who technically own the Fed banks. And then it's not as if the Fed, if they have profits, It's not like they go to JP Morgan. The Fed remits profits to the U.S. Treasury. So that's right. Important to note. And then also Congress can make changes to the Fed's mandate, which has happened in the past. So there's like something in the 70s that was Humphrey Hawkins, Dodd-Frank in the 2010s had implications for how the Fed operates. So there is like congressional oversight.
There's mechanisms for oversight.
Yeah, there is. So I just feel like I should point that out for balance. But I don't think any of that changes the fact that what is the Fed's underlying purpose? It's to allow the commercial banks to continue what they do in a very profitable way without being killed by a financial crisis.
Yeah. And because it operates that way, the system operates that way, the crises tend to benefit, you know, these banks and the major corporations and high net worth individuals ultimately after the dust settles. It seems to be the case more often than not.
Yeah.
Speaking of big banks, let's take it. Here's Saylor. Made a little cryptic tweet here. Guess the bank, the Bitcoin symbol for the B in bank. He was at JP Morgan, and there's been some tension between Saylor and MicroStrategy and JP Morgan in the past. But here he is, perhaps trying to build a relationship with JP Morgan. And any notes on this, John?
Yeah, I would say this was not Saylor trying to be secretive. I think he's aware that people can put this photo into Grok or any other.
Yeah, which is what happened. Yeah,
which is exactly what happened. And people said, yeah, this is JP Morgan's headquarters based on what direction it's facing and the other luxury high rise buildings that you can see in the Manhattan skyline in the background there.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you said, there's definitely been some tension. There's been some theories that JP Morgan was trying to harm or put pressure on MicroStrategy's stock by not allowing it to be used for margin. And then they also promoted this piece that talked about Strategy being under pressure because they might get kicked out of some MSCI indices.
Yep.
I don't feel like I'm an expert on either one of those topics, to be honest with you. So I couldn't go into like a ton of detail on either of those. I just know those narratives are out there. So given that context of like the last month or so, it's pretty interesting that Saylor's in their building, presumably having a meeting with them. Maybe we'll find out in the next week or two if something material was discussed.
Yeah. It's just another sign that these big banks are embracing Bitcoin. Jamie Dimon famously called Bitcoin a fraud. There's a cartoon that I can't, the name is escaping me at the moment of this cartoon. You know it, John. There was an episode where Swan was featured.
Tuttle Twins?
Tuttle Twins, thank you. Yeah, the Tuttle Twins show. They do great educational cartoon shows, and they're Bitcoiners, and so they've done Bitcoin episodes in the past that are really fantastic. You could check them out on YouTube. But there was one scene one where they had Uncle Jamie as a character, and he was playing with his pet rocks, and it's pretty great. So I definitely check that out. It's a little shout out for the Tuttle Twins. All right, we got some quick hits here. We're staying on this theme of banks. The segues have been fantastic in the show. staying on banks, BitGo has secured regulatory approval to become a bank. They said Friday that it received conditional approval from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency to convert to a bank. Unlike full-service national banks, BitGo would be a trust bank, which focuses on custody and asset management, fiduciary services, without traditional like deposit taking or lending. But they do gain authority to handle digital assets nationwide. So they will be able to operate nationwide, no more state hurdles. They'll shift to a federal license. It'll boost, obviously, you know, this is kind of the benefits, right, of this move, help boost credibility and institutional trust with OCC oversight. They announced 100% reserves to eliminate bank run risks, provide bankruptcy protection, and attract conservative institutions who are wary of the Wild West of crypto. They'll expand services and revenue growth, and they are positioning themselves strategically in this maturing market. So yeah, this is a I think a relatively big move for BitGo, obviously, and for the Bitcoin industry, just further integrating into the traditional finance system and acting as the Trojan horse that it is. So this is, you know, the path to becoming the global reserve currency, if that is Bitcoin's final destination and end state, then, you know, this is the kind of thing that must happen, where you see Bitcoin companies and, you know, Mike Belshi, I would call him a Bitcoiner. He was very early in Bitcoin. And yes, BitGo does service some cryptos, but primarily they're a Bitcoin company in my mind. Obviously they're not a Bitcoin only company, but this is how Bitcoin does the Trojan horse thing. It integrates into the financial system and into national treasuries, and eventually it will become trusted enough via, simply because it is integrated into this traditional finance system, to hopefully revolutionize the way that money flows through the traditional finance system, the way money operates, the traits of money, the nature of money itself, to really bring those benefits that we talk about a lot, the societal benefits of Bitcoin, whereas fiat money really incentivizes short-term vision. You've got to plop your money down into these sort of short-term speculative bets so that you can outpace inflation. Bitcoin's the opposite. You can hold on to that money. You're not forced to invest it. You can invest it in something that will see returns over a long period of time, with confidence that you're not going to be being diluted through inflation over years and decades. And so you'll see real returns and shift our thinking as a society to be more long-term, to invest in things that will really benefit society for the future generations, whereas the fiat money is really robbing from future generations. We've talked about this many times. Inflation is really just theft from our children, our grandchildren, and just places a burden on them to service all of the debt and interest that's been built up in past generations. Obviously, this isn't fair, but this is the kind of societal change, really fundamental. Like, Bitcoin's the opposite of fiat. And so we would be able to build a society on the foundation of Bitcoin that hopefully would be a whole lot more humane, I guess is a good way to put it.
Well said. And I was just looking for Peter McCormick's, you know, to be fair, this is something Bitcoiners have been talking about for a very long time, but he phrased it in, I think, a really, really beneficial or clear way, concise way. Ending inflationary economics would be the biggest tax on the rich and a tax break for the poor.
Exactly.
You know, feel like we're all, within Bitcoin, we're all trying to get through to the normal people. we just try repeatedly. What if we say it this way? What if we say it this way?
Yep.
Maybe more people will understand. But I think he found a sentence that really works. So I just wanted to highlight that one.
Yeah. So many in this country, and it's similar around the world, don't have the capability, meaning they don't have the savings or the extra cash, to invest in the S&P, which is what people who do have the means to save and invest use to outpace inflation, right? Or, you know, now you have Bitcoin as an option as well. And so everyone who's living paycheck to paycheck just gets punished by the fiat system. And all of those who have the money to invest, which they're getting at the top of this pyramid, this sometimes free money to the big banks in the Federal Reserve System, then that filters down at higher and higher rates. When you get to the bottom of the pyramid, you've got people who are paying running credit card interest rates and payday loans and stuff like that just to survive. They don't have any money to invest, so they can't benefit from this fiat system, and they're just stuck. And that, you know, filters down to future generations, and it's just not fair. It's simply not fair.
Yeah, and just on the BitGo news, I'll just add a few comments. I think it's really cool to see Mike Belshi give this quote. BitGo is now a federal national bank, but unlike traditional banks, we always hold 100% reserves. That means we don't lend out client assets, we secure them. We create a fortress that eliminates the risk of a bank run. It's kind of amazing. In the fiat system, there have been a couple instances where someone tried to create a fiat dollar denominated full reserve bank.
Right.
And they got declined. the Fed and different
OCC.
That's
not how this works, guys.
Yeah, no. You guys have to run the same scheme that we're all running.
Yeah.
It's interesting in the digital asset world, and BitGo does deal with more than Bitcoin, but I think the vast majority of what they deal with is Bitcoin. And obviously that's what we care about. And we think what the future is going to be. They are doing full reserve of a bearer asset. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that it is a bearer asset. On a long enough time frame, there will be some custodian that potentially loses assets to theft or a hack or law or just loss or user error. The same way that if a custodian had gold in their vaults, there are some custodians that lost the gold for some reason, right? That will happen. That just is a reality of a bearer asset. But just think about the differences in risk. A bank run, which is a financial crisis because you lent out too many made up IOUs on top of your base money, that's the risk of the traditional banking model.
Yep.
The risk of BitGo is they get hacked, they didn't set up their systems correctly, and they just lose that underlying bearer asset. It's really like just two totally different risks. Hopefully people remember that, even though BitGo is now on the books as a bank, just two totally different risk models.
Do Kwon let me flip this around real quick. Do Kwon, sentenced to 15 years in jail over the Terra Luna blowup. Our CEO, Corey Clipson, which many of you probably know from Twitter and elsewhere, really played a role in helping to expose the Terra Luna Ponzi scheme. And, it's fulfilling. It's nice to see this, really brought to justice. This was, of course, along the same years as Celsius and FTX, the same year as Celsius and FTX. So we had three big blowups that year in the crypto world. This one was the just most obvious Ponzi scheme, easy to pick apart. And fortunately, I think a lot of people were saved who had money in this from Corey and others on Twitter calling this out and explaining what was going on, but also a lot of people got completely rugged here. So Do Kwon sentenced to 15 years.
Now I can't remember it. It was on the tip of my tongue, but what was the, you had to take your, so they had the Terra, I think UST was their acronym.
Yeah.
And you had to take that was the stable coin. It was an algorithmic stable coin linked to Luna. Luna was the free floating one, which obviously basically went to zero eventually. But then there was you had to put what people were doing, they were taking their Terra and then putting it in some protocol and getting like 20%. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
I forget the name of that particular protocol, but the point I wanted to make was, for me, I'll be honest, I never even gave these things like 2 seconds of thought, because all I needed to see was that, oh, you can put this algorithmic stable coin in some protocol and get 20%. And I'm just like, that's a scam. I don't know how it's a scam, but that's a scam. And I didn't think I wanted to take the time. Like, Corey actually sat down and said, okay, how does this thing work? Now I'm going to tell people how it works or doesn't work. And he was obviously proven true, proven correct. That thing had red flags from the beginning. Just historically, it is interesting how, because they were buying Bitcoin for their reserve, I'm sure you remember all this, he kind of got in the good graces with certain Bitcoiners, because they're like, oh, he's buying Bitcoin.
Yep.
But that unraveled fairly quickly.
And that's a very common strategy of scammers throughout crypto history, is to what we call orange wash their project by embracing Bitcoin to legitimize what they're doing. And Do Kwon absolutely orange washed. He definitely pulled the wool over some people's eyes. And then there was this guy. I don't think the wool was pulled over this guy's eyes. I have to assume he knew what was going on there. But this is Mike Novogratz of Galaxy. Famously got the Luna tattoo and posted it to Twitter. Yeah, so that's interesting.
Yeah, some justice being served, as they would say.
Absolutely. All right, one more here. On this day 15 years ago, the mysterious inventor of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, made their final public post, then disappeared. The engineer's true identity remains a mystery. Bitcoin remains operational, having no founder to call, control it, or change the rules. So this was this is the anniversary of the disappearance of Satoshi. And that happened in the context of Bitcoin being accepted by WikiLeaks as, to help fund or as a donation, basically to support their operation. And Satoshi posted famously that WikiLeaks had kicked the hornet's nest. And then Gavin Andreessen, who was really the kind of senior participant in the Bitcoin community, he was a coder, he was trusted by Satoshi, he had access to the GitHub repo, etc., and was influential, went to the CIA, accepted an invitation from the CIA to go and talk to them about what Bitcoin is. So Gavin Andreessen went to the CIA. WikiLeaks started accepting Bitcoin, and Satoshi was like, "I'm out, I'm out." That was the context of his disappearance, which, you know, sort of makes sense.
Yeah, it probably was good timing. If they stuck around for longer, maybe, who knows? Maybe somebody would have been, whoever did know who Satoshi was, maybe would have been more incentivized to leak it, or maybe different communications would have pointed to who they were. Who knows? Probably a good thing that Satoshi decided to leave at that point in time.
100%. Yeah, that was the right time. And it's, I think the two gifts that Satoshi gave us, one is Bitcoin itself, the white paper, the Genesis block, working through the first couple of years to get Bitcoin bootstrapped and off the ground, and then disappearing, which has been, I think, an absolutely essential part of Bitcoin's success. There is no leader, unlike other cryptos, Vitalik Buterin and the like. Bitcoin truly is a neutral asset with no leader. And I think that's absolutely crucial to Bitcoin's success and continued success.
Yeah. Yeah. And just on the time, time periods, it's kind of amazing to me. If the white paper was January 2009, call that at the beginning of 2009, Satoshi leaves at the end of 2010, just under 2 years, call it 2 years until he disappears. 2 years is really not that long. FTX was 3 years ago. Swan's been around for over 6 years as a company.
Right.
The fact that it was relatively quick that he decided to build this thing. Obviously, some of the building happened in 2008. So whatever, you could call it 3 years if you want to, that Satoshi was building.
Kind of 2 years publicly.
Yeah, 2 years public, maybe a year private before that. And then Satoshi disappeared. It's so much happened in such a short period.
Truly a Promethean story, right? Prometheus famously stole fire from Zeus and gave it to the people to empower the people. And, in this case, the fire is Bitcoin and Prometheus is Satoshi. And so it's really a remarkable story, individual, really having a very selfless action. And the Bitcoin that is in the quote unquote Satoshi wallet has been there and untouched since then, since the beginning, all accumulated from Satoshi mining in the early days to support the network. Hats off to Satoshi. All right, let's take a quick look at Swan Bitcoin. All right, Swan. John and I work at Swan. I'm a co-founder of Swan and been there since about 2019. In March 2020, right at the beginning of COVID in the United States, we launched our product, which was a very simple Bitcoin-only DCA product, a recurring buy product where you could buy daily, weekly, or monthly and save Bitcoin. And that was all the product did when it first launched. Now we have built out a full financial services system, financial services company built on top of Bitcoin and only Bitcoin. And I think the defining trait of Swan is that we are human, right? That we work as humans, develop relationships with our clients. And those are very long-term relationships. We're focused and aligned with your long-term interests as you build generational wealth with Bitcoin. And John is a managing director of Swan Private and has a lot of those relationships with his clients. And I know that they deeply appreciate the relationship with John and with our other Swan Private representatives. We also have an incredible tech team that has built out ironclad security system. It's SOC 2 Type 2 compliant, which is a very difficult compliance to get. We also have Swan Guard. This is our proprietary layer of security that involves all kinds of things to combat fraud, which we do on a daily basis. The fraudsters and the scammers out there are absolutely relentless, and we do a great job to help keep people's Bitcoin safe and help recover Bitcoin when they may be going down the path of being defrauded. We host events all over the country, live events, in-person events where we hang out with our clients and we bring in great guests to have awesome discussions. And we develop insightful research and education, including this YouTube channel, which you should subscribe to now if you haven't yet. Hurley, who's the producer of this show, also produces his own show and hosts his own show called No Second Best on this channel. Extremely popular on YouTube. We have over 220,000 subs on the channel, so you should definitely do that if you have not yet. You can go to the site and learn all about Swan Private. We also have an IRA product. You can go here and check out the calculator, put in all your own assumptions and see how adding Bitcoin to your IRA would help you really turbocharge your retirement plans. We also have Swan Vault, which is our collaborative multi-signature cold storage system. This is really, I think, the best way for almost everyone to hold Bitcoin. You have full control over your Bitcoin, full self-custody, but you don't have to go it alone. We've developed this service in conjunction with Blockstream and Adam Back, and you can watch the video here to learn more from Adam Back and our CTO and co-founder, Jan Pritzker, and from our friend, Lynn Alden, as well. You can learn about our custody stack, check out all of our research. So go to swan.com/SSL to learn more about Swan, and we would really love to work with you on your plan for Bitcoin accumulation, build generational wealth. We have inheritance services. We have asset-backed lending services as well. That's all done through Swan Private. So if you are really serious about building a Bitcoin stack for your future and your children's future, grandchildren's future, check out Swan Private. I think it's the best service out there. John, do you have any comments on Swan Private and your involvement there and what it means to you and your clients?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just crushed the overview there. So the one thing I'll add is Bitcoin is obviously this decentralized, trustless, permissionless asset. We want Bitcoin itself to remain that, but most people are not going to interact with Bitcoin in every way have no partner, no trust, no centralized entity. So some of the entities you want to work with, whether it is for buying Bitcoin in the name of yourself, your IRA, your trust, your corporate entity, you're going to want to work with a trustworthy partner to do that. Someone who has a good track record, but also someone who has human beings that you can talk to. That's in terms of the functionality of the platform, but it is much more than that. Like you said, Brady, education and in-person events as well for Swan Private. So that's, yeah, just a little bit of an elaboration, but I think your summary killed it. And we're always adding more features to the platform. We ultimately want it to be the most comprehensive Bitcoin-only financial services platform out there. So you should see more from us in the coming months and years.
Yeah. And as more of those banks come online into Bitcoin and allowing clients to buy Bitcoin, accumulate Bitcoin, et cetera, I think the differentiating factor here at Swan is that we are Bitcoiners. We are Bitcoin experts. We understand this asset in a deep way. And I think it is really advantageous to partner with a company in the Bitcoin-only space. And there's several other companies as well. But I think Swan's the best. And we would love to work with you guys. So go to swan.com/SSL right after we end the show here in just a moment. And check out the website and just learn more about Swan and get in touch with us. All right. That's it. Until next week. Thanks, everybody. We appreciate y'all. Take care.
See ya.